Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll preview a big political event coming to Illinois next week, the Democratic National Convention to be held in Chicago. We'll look ahead at police preparation and what some delegates think about the Harris-Walz ticket. Media outlets covering the convention have to shell out a lot of money. Not all can afford to do so. We'll have that report. And you can't talk about a Democratic National Convention in Chicago without recalling 1968, when protesters clashed with police on the streets and the convention itself turned into a free-for-all. We'll hear from someone who was there. And Chicago can claim host to more political conventions than any city in the U.S. We'll look back at what history was made at some of those gatherings. Those stories and more this hour here on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead of the upcoming Democratic National Convention, the Chicago Police Department says it is ready for street protests. The department says it won't be caught off guard, like during the 2020 unrest after George Floyd's murder. To see if police are succeeding, Chip Mitchell says to keep an eye on four things.
I spoke with a bunch of experts about how they'll judge the department's performance next week. They told me the first thing they'll be watching is how CPD responds to trouble at protests. Police Superintendent Larry Snelling says the department will be on the lookout for violent actors.
Committing acts of vandalism, violent attacks against the police, against each other, against our citizens. That's the type of thing that we're not going to tolerate. The minute that starts, we have to put an end to it. When people become comfortable committing acts of violence and vandalism, that's when it turns into a riot.
Police can use batons, but if they're striking heads under a new CPD policy, that's deadly force and has to be documented. Chicago Inspector General Deborah Witzberg says her office found CPD policy also allows police to use pepper spray on people who are not actively resisting cops.
And that is in contrast with national standards.
Civic Federation President Joe Ferguson says any use of force should be surgically focused.
On those who are attempting to trigger chaos and mob action. And even if we were to see some of that activity, it is still the responsibility of CPD, of the officers, of their field supervisors, to make sure that the force that is used is no more than is necessary.
The second thing to keep an eye on next week is whether cops protect constitutional rights. Superintendent Snelling says they understand their duty.
All of our officers have gone through over 40 hours of field force training. That training is rooted in the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment.
A coalition sponsoring what could be the largest protest march during the convention pointed to the First Amendment in a lawsuit that won a rout within sight and sound of the convention goers. But John Catanzara, he heads the Fraternal Order of Police Lodge for Chicago cops, he points to limits on those rights. He brings up some George Floyd protesters 4 years ago. They surrounded officers at the Columbus statue in Grant Park and pelted them with fireworks and bottles of frozen water.
An organized group of deviants, criminals, pieces of garbage, quite frankly, who had no regard for human life. And officers are human. So you have a First Amendment right, but that doesn't mean you get to break the law in the commission of exercising your First Amendment rights.
The Fourth Amendment protects people from unreasonable search and seizure. Inspector General Witzberg says she'll be watching for kettling. That's a police tactic to essentially trap a crowd to make a mass arrest easier.
If any members of that group of people are lawful demonstrators, then any containment of them risks an inappropriate infringing on their Fourth Amendment rights.
The third thing to keep an eye on during the convention is the rest of Chicago. Here's Snelling, the top cop, at a business luncheon.
I want to reassure everyone that we will have resources in every single neighborhood so that it's not forgotten that we have a city to protect. It's not just around the venues covering the Democratic National Convention.
Over the last decade, the 7 days beginning August 19th have averaged 14 murders and 72 non-fatal shootings. Ferguson, the Civic Federation president, he says he'll watch next week's numbers.
We could have a fantastic success with the convention, only to find ourselves with an uptick or outbreaks of violence in the neighborhoods that will raise the question of whether or not we are adequately staffed and resourced to attend to all of the needs we put on the police department.
And finally, the fourth thing to watch during the DNC is police exhaustion. Superintendent Snelling says he's on it.
We're going to have to extend hours. There are going to be day off cancellations, but there's also wellness plans in place for our officers to make sure that cognitively our officers are effective when they're responding.
How effective? Chicagoans will soon find out. Chip Mitchell, WBEZ News.
Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson is in charge of welcoming all, from delegates to high-profile officials to protesters. Tessa Weinberg has more on what this moment means for Chicago's freshman mayor.
Hosting the Democratic National Convention would be a challenge for any mayor, and especially for one in his first term who inherited the event. Mayor Brandon Johnson faces a political tightrope, like how he'll handle tens of thousands of expected protesters. He's already had his progressive credentials criticized by organizers like Andy Thayer. Thayer is a member of the group Bodies Outside of Unjust Laws, which has sued the city over protest routes.
That's not the way that a progressive mayor should be behaving. This whole mass arrest policy, the security perimeter, call into question Mayor Johnson's real commitment to the First Amendment.
On the flip side, Democratic strategist Pete Jean Greco says there's also a concern that Johnson will be too lenient with protesters.
The mayor cannot be such a cheerleader for the First Amendment that he looks like he's on the side of protesters, most of whom will be peaceful, but not all of them will be.
The double bind isn't lost on Johnson.
What's ironic about this is that there are some people that are concerned that I'm too friendly to the right to protest.
As a former organizer, Johnson says his firsthand experience gives him a greater appreciation for the power of protest.
I've led massive demonstrations. I've taken arrests. I know how important it is to make sure that voices are heard. I'm going to protect that right.
Observers are anxious to see if the Chicago Police Department learned lessons from its handling of protests in 2020. The city is still paying out millions of dollars in settlements from those events. Bahatem Abudeya, the national chair for the U.S.-Palestinian Community Network, says Johnson's administration has engaged in good faith negotiations over protest routes. He says they'd be acting very differently if former mayors Rahm Emanuel or Lori Lightfoot were overseeing the convention.
Because, you know, we do think of Brandon Johnson as being from and of the movement.
But he warned that regardless of Johnson's past, if people's rights are violated, then the police and city will be a political target of theirs. As the mayor of the convention's host city, Johnson will largely be expected to be the party's cheerleader in chief. But he hasn't always been in lockstep with the Biden administration when it comes to the war in Gaza and Biden's immigration policies. Johnson demurred when a reporter asked whether he'll pursue a primetime speaking role at the convention.
You're making me blush. Look, my main focus right now is ensuring that we have a safe, vibrant convention.
That's what residents will want to see. They'll be watching if neighborhoods will still be kept safe and whether they'll be able to navigate the extra traffic. Johnson's administration has already been tidying up the city with flowers and art installations. Chief Operating Officer John Roberson likened the pre-convention cleanup to a homeowner hosting a barbecue.
When you host things at your house, you cut the grass, don't you? You plant flowers. But you put that extra emphasis because you want people to walk away feeling like, when I went to Steve's house, it was phenomenal.
But those beautification efforts included a homeless encampment being cleared. Johnson faced quick pushback from progressives like Alderperson Andre Vasquez.
But because this is an inconvenience to the party, all of a sudden these things are being moved. I think there's a lot to question about that, about our values as a city.
Bill Daley helped his brother, then Mayor Richard M. Daley, stage the 1996 DNC. And Bill Daley says there's only so much that can prepare the city for what's to come.
It's not really just the preparation. It's how you react when the proverbial stuff hits the fan.
Johnson's administration is confident. Roberson proclaimed that the city is more prepared this time around than when it last hosted the convention under Daley.
Tessa Weinberg reporting. Maria Gardner-Laura checks in now with a Northern Illinois delegate to the DNC to learn what she's saying about the top of the ticket.
Sarah Bingaman says the switch at the top of the Democratic ticket will bring energy in the next several months left before Election Day.
I think with Vice President Harris's laugh and her willingness to joke around and her willingness to dance and have fun, it's going to be Make America Fun Again.
Bingaman is one of four elected delegates to the Democratic National Convention representing the 16th Congressional District. Beyond Vice President Kamala Harris' laugh, Bingaman says she's qualified in part due to her work under the Biden administration.
So when people vote for Kamala Harris for president, they'll be voting for an entire administration. And she's been a big part of that administration for the last 4 years.
And she's a big fan of the administration, from its work to strengthen NATO, protect same-sex marriage and LGBTQ rights, and approach to the economy.
He has brought jobs back from overseas, and we know that in Illinois because we can just look at Belvedere and see what is happening there.
She's from Dixon in Lee County. That's the hometown of the late President Ronald Reagan and is considered heavily Republican. It's one of the red dots in a blue state. In the 2020 election, Donald Trump won 59% of the votes in the county. That's compared to 40% statewide. She serves as chair of the Voter Outreach Committee for the Lee County Democrats.
The committee that puts together the brochures and organizes the door knocking and the phone banking and postcard mailing and all of those kinds of things.
She says they're extra cautious as they navigate a contentious election season.
We're careful about where we send people because there are high emotions in this election. Of course, we don't have anybody ring a doorbell when there is a TRUMP sign out front or flag.
Her interest in politics stems from her former profession as a public school teacher. She says the Democratic Party has always been supportive of public schools and teachers' unions.
The Republican view is that charter schools and private schools should be supported by public money. I strongly disagree.
She plans on working with her teachers' union and hopes to influence the party's platform on education at the convention. Becoming a delegate has been a goal of Bingaman's for some time. She tried in the 1970s. In 2020, she applied to be a Pete Buttigieg delegate but wasn't selected. She was all in for President Joe Biden, and so she wasn't initially very happy to hear that he was dropping his reelection bid.
I was very sad for a couple of hours until I realized that this is his choice. He knows what he's doing, and we need to trust him. Let's get on with the show.
She says Vice President Harris' candidacy will spur enthusiasm in the youth vote, and women excited to elect the first female president of the United States.
It's really just about time. And I think a lot of women who might have stayed home or a lot of women who might have voted Republican now will be anxious to vote for Vice President Harris.
The Democratic National Convention begins on August 19th in Chicago. I'm Maria Garner Lara.
The convention is expected to be a glitzy four-day affair. It will generate news stories and headlines around the world. But the event can be expensive for newsrooms to cover. It can cost media outlets hundreds of thousands of dollars to reserve a table, chair, and internet near the United Center. For some smaller, hyper-local outlets in Chicago, that's out of their price range. And they worry it means their readers could miss out too. Tessa Weinberg with WBEZ has more.
If a newsroom wants an assigned chair at a table with access to an electrical outlet at the Democratic National Convention, that will cost them $751. If they miss the advance rate, that will go up to $911. And hardline internet costs are separate. When Erica Hobbs, editor of the Austin Weekly News, saw those prices, she
took a deep breath and I rolled my eyes.
Hobbs says the cost was way too high for the scrappy weekly newspaper that covers the west side of Chicago.
And there was just no way we can shell that out at this point.
To be clear, there is a way to cover the event for free. Credentials to get inside the building don't cost anything. And there's even a space set aside with tables, chairs, internet, and electricity on a first-come, first-served basis for the 15,000 journalists covering the event. That's what the Austin Weekly News is planning to do. The more elaborate setups that bigger newsrooms use cost thousands of dollars. Some outlets that focus on covering politics and policy are eating the costs in order to have a dedicated workspace. But Hermine Hartman, the founder of Indigo Magazine, says the high prices mean smaller local outlets will miss out on covering a major political event in their backyard.
I won't be in attendance for a hefty price. And here's the reason. They can charge ABC and NBC and CBS thousands of dollars because they get it back in something called advertising. We don't get that money. We should, but we don't. I'd be damned if I would pay them to cover them.
It's local news outlets that will be covering how the convention reverberates into the neighborhoods. And Hobbs says it's readers that will ultimately lose out.
And if we're talking about healthy democracies, if we're talking about things like healthy civic discourse, then all voices need to be included in that. And that goes back to the pricing.
The costs come at a time when local news is declining at an accelerating rate. And as the DNC invites social media influencers to cover the convention for the first time, as announced in its own social media video.
For the first time ever,
the Democratic National Convention
is credentialing content creators.
And guess what? Now I'm one of them.
In August,
there's been no mention of costs for their access, but the DNC says traditional media won't lose space for it. Some of the influencers are popular internet personalities, but others are more involved in Democratic politics, including one who is a political strategist that serves on Kamala Harris's National Finance Committee. The move raises questions for some journalists about whether viewers will be able to tell the difference between them and influencers. Southside Weekly's Jim Daly says viewers are savvy, but it still presents a risk.
There's a chance that credentialing someone who's wearing a Harris button and just doing PR for the Democratic Party, that definitely could delegitimize actual press that's nonpartisan.
Sherman Dilla Thomas says that line is already blurred. He's a Chicagoan known for his TikTok videos and bus tours that highlight Chicago history. He'll be at the DNC, and he says even convention officials recommended influencers adopt some journalistic standards when citing numbers or policies.
Their only ask was that if you're one of the people who is credentialed, maybe it's in good faith that you reach out to the congressman or senator or legislative aide that you're quoting to give them an opportunity to, you know, explain themselves.
Either way, the new model is a litmus test for influencers, the convention, and traditional media, Thomas says.
We all may need to shift and change the way that we do things. A common thing I say all the time is, like 15 years ago, if something happened on the news, then that's what people turned into memes. And now, if something is a cool meme, then it pops up on the news.
As for WBEZ, we splurged. We've got one chair. Tessa Weinberg, WBEZ News.
Still to come, we'll remember the Democratic National Convention of 1968. You're listening to Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Local and federal officials are projecting extreme confidence ahead of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago next week. Derek Meyer, who heads the Secret Service Chicago field office, spoke at a news conference this week. He waved away safety concerns prompted by the attempted assassination of former President Trump earlier this summer.
You can't compare it. This is a whole of government approach. We've been planning for this convention for well over a year, so we can't compare the two.
Meyer says Chicago and the Secret Service have proven track records of keeping major events safe. That convention starts Monday and will largely take place at the United Center in Chicago. Well, that means Democrats will be descending on Chicago as early as this weekend, getting set for the convention. This is only the second time the convention will be held in the Windy City since the infamous 1968 event, which devolved into chaos amid protests over the Vietnam War, on the streets, and on the convention floor. Then the whole world was watching. Here's CBS News' Dan Rather from the floor.
I mean, manhandling.
And what is your name, sir? Take your hands off of me.
Dan Rather.
Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please.
Sir,
I know you will, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you intend to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
Walter, as you can see.
I don't know what's going on, but these are security people apparently around Dan. And obviously getting roughed up.
We tried to talk to the man, and we got bodily pushed out of the way. This is the kind of thing that's been going on outside the hall. This is the first time we've had it happen inside the hall.
6 years ago, we discussed that famous convention on its 50th anniversary. We spoke with Taylor Pensoneau, an author and former reporter who covered the event for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Mark Depew, who directed the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library's Oral History Program. Today, we revisit that conversation. Taylor, let me start with you. What were you expecting when you went? I know word was out that there were going to be some major demonstrations. Were you a little bit of trepidation going into that?
A little bit, Sean. But of course, I never anticipated what occurred. I had no idea, and I don't think many other individuals tied to the convention had any idea what would occur, what would develop before it was over. Frankly, I like to say that before it was over, I was a witness to what Norman Mailer, the author Norman Mailer, called the Siege of Chicago. It was absolutely a city under attack. Its functioning was disrupted. I have never, can't imagine ever seeing another disruptive scene, more chaotic. It was, many aspects, it was unbelievable. And I got up there a few days earlier to write some political stories, but of course, as you already said, rumors were swirling that the protesters were going to be out in force. They were already coming in droves, and the expectations were that there was going to be extreme activity, to put it mildly, on the streets of Chicago, and that certainly that certainly enveloped. In my case, I've got the experience, fortunately or unfortunately, most aspects of it. I covered the actual convention itself down in the International Amphitheater, but I also spent time with some of the protesters in or on the edge of Grand Park, and the Post-Dispatch had leased space in the bottom our basement of the Conrad Hilton Hotel. That's where we wrote our stories. And the Conrad Hilton Hotel, of course, was the headquarters for McCarthy, and it was absolutely crammed with protesters and other individuals. You couldn't turn around. And I was, in one way or another, involved in frankly, in all of it.
You were still a relatively young reporter at the time.
I was. So I tried to figure it out, and I was going to tell Mark that. I think I was 27 years old at the time.
Well, you know, I think as reporters, often you're witness to history, but you don't know it as much. You don't realize what the impact's going to be long term. Did you realize that then, that this was going to be something that was really, really going to stand out in history and politics?
I did, Sean. Yeah, I recognize that I was part of a journalistic part of something that would be an irrevocable memory for the rest of my life, and for something that I realized the whole world was watching. In fact, in one of the protests, I think it was Wednesday night, thousands of protesters were shouting in unison, "Remember, the whole world is watching." So I would say yes. I accurately felt that this was something that would never be forgotten in modern American political history. Could not be erased.
One of those people who was watching, Mark, that was you. At the time, I'm not sure how old you were back then, but you were paying attention to what was going on.
I was 14 years old, and like a lot of people, I was watching it all on TV. I remember, the whole world is watching. The whole world is watching. And I'd already gotten really interested in American politics, and I certainly was paying attention to that.
As part of the oral history program here in with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, you've talked to a lot of people who were involved in politics. That moment stands out in the state's history, doesn't it?
It sure does. In fact, I've got a pretty standard list of questions I ask when I get to 1968, because it was such a pivotal and important year in American history. Of course, as you and your listeners will recall, it starts with the Tet Offensive at the end of January, and that pretty much changed people's perception of the Vietnam War. Then you've got Johnson's decision to drop out of the race, and on April 4th of that year is the night that Martin Luther King was assassinated, and of course, cities across the country exploded in violence after that. Then in June, you've got Robert Kennedy's assassination. There were things going on internationally. There were Columbia University sit-in. The students had taken over the university campus. It was a crazy year, but nothing was as crazy as what happened at the Democratic Convention.
And there was a lot of activity going on outside, as we've talked about, but it seems to me it was just as wild on the convention floor. Things that I've seen, archive video of that. People, delegates being hauled out of the convention center. I mean, it was pretty crazy, wasn't it?
Well, I can simply say that some of the states had rival delegations that came to Chicago, and there were all sorts of controversies over what delegations would be seated and which ones would be rebuffed, and there were divisions on the convention floor. It seemed like in many of the positions, there were many sympathizers with the protesters, especially among the New York and California delegates. I remember that. And then you had more conservative delegations from obviously states like, you know, Alabama, Georgia, and so on. There were fisticuffs on the convention floor. Sometimes there was outright disorder, which is not all that unusual at a national convention, but it was much more aggravated, I thought, and much more tense from the opening bell at the amphitheater where the convention was held.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six policemen came in here, some of them wearing the blue helmets of the Chicago Police Force, and they are dragging out of here the people who were involved in this. One delegate from New York who objected to having his credentials checked.
This surely is the first time that policemen have ever entered a convention, the floor of a convention.
In the United States.
Colorado. Mr. Chairman, Colorado rises to a point of information. Is there any rule under which Mayor Daley can be compelled to suspend the police state terror perpetrated this minute on kids in front of the Conrad Hilton?
As I look at the confusion in this hall and watch on television the turmoil and violence that is competing with this great convention for the attention of the American people, and with George McGovern as President of the United States, we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago. With George McGovern, we wouldn't have a National Guard.
That sound from the floor of the convention and also outside. You heard Abe Ribicoff there making the announcement of the Gestapo tactics, as he termed them. Former Mayor Daley, the older Mayor Daley, he took offense to that, of course, gesturing at the time after that line was delivered. It seemed like the party was coming apart at the seams. Did it feel that way to you at the time?
Well, it definitely did. The divisions were very steep, and there was great hostility within the party. But back to the Daley Ribicoff thing, that's one of the episodes or anecdotes I like to relate. I was on the floor at that time interviewing the Illinois delegates, which were essentially the Chicago Democratic delegates. I was kneeling down. Reporters like me were allowed to go out for like 10-minute periods, and then you had to come back to the sidelines. That was during one of my 10-minute periods. I was literally kneeling down, talking to a Democratic member of the Daley entourage, Francis Lorenz, and Mayor Daley was seated either right next to Lorenz or no more than two chairs down. And Ribicoff was on the podium, and he was taking off on Daley, the Gestapo tactics and all that. And Daley erupted and started shouting, you know, shut up, you know, cut it out, get off the podium. And then Daley cuffed his hands around his mouth and started to boo. And immediately, all of the Democratic delegates, they were all Daley people, of course, all in unison started to boo along with Daley. Whatever Daley did, they echoed. It was automatic. And it was very dramatic. And I've even seen pictures, elongated pictures, of the line of seats where Daley was seated. And you can see me crouched behind Francis Lorenz's chair. And it's just a very memorable moment. And, of course, that was my lead in the next day's story, and that was the major story in the Post-Dispatch the next morning, obviously.
We're talking with former reporter and author Taylor Pinsoneau and Mark DePue, who was the oral history director for the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. We spoke with them on the 50th anniversary of the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Today we're revisiting the conversation as another convention gets set to take place. Mark, there has been protesting at every convention since. I'm sure there were some protests before that one as well. Why does this one resonate so much?
Well, it was all about the students had a lot of things. The protesters had a lot of things. But the Vietnam War was really the central thing. And Taylor was talking about what was going on at the convention itself. One of the things that really got into a heated debate, and I think it was the second night of the convention, was one of the planks of the platform, which was about an anti-war plank. And it was finally defeated after a very lengthy discussion, and that really fired up the crowds and got them going, because that was what they wanted to see. They wanted Eugene McCarthy to emerge out of this thing, which was not going to happen, and they wanted that peace plank. And you know, the whole nation, because of what had happened earlier in the year and gotten disillusioned about the Vietnam War, and you only see that protest against the war growing after this. But that was really one of the flashpoints.
It didn't reflect well, of course, on the Democratic Party at the time, but Chicago itself, it's always had this image of a rough and tumble city, I guess going back to Al Capone, many others. But the imagery that was delivered right into the country's living rooms, that had a lasting impact as well.
Yeah, it sure did. And as Taylor was reporting as well, one of the aftermaths of that is what has become known as the Walker Report. A future Illinois governor, Dan Walker, was an attorney for Montgomery Ward, was selected to head up that commission. And once the report eventually came out, he declared that this was a police riot.
And Taylor, did you talk with any police officers? Have you talked with some in the past about it and their views?
I talked to police officers at the time, Sean, and their instructions were to brook no disorder. Apparently, there had been riots earlier in the year in Chicago surrounding, like, the death of Martin Luther King Jr. and so on. And at that time, many felt that the official response from law enforcement was not sufficient. And Mayor Daley had given strict orders to brook no property damage, open hostility. This was supposed to be, you know, Daley was the most prominent political figure in America at the time. And this was to be the apex or the premier moment of his long control of Chicago. This was his baby. He wanted this convention in Chicago, and he had dedicated all of his available resources to make it the most memorable political convention of all time in modern American political history. And of course, that happened, but it didn't happen the way he wanted. Nevertheless, this convention was Daley's baby, and it's incredible that it turned out the way it did, especially in view of the fact that he had such control over all of the political mechanism, really not just of Chicago, but of the state in many regards.
And if I can add, Sean, on the other side, the students and the protesters who are coming, people like Abby Hoffman, who was head of a group called the Yippies, Youth International Party, right, Taylor?
Right, Mark.
They had it in their minds, the small minority of the protesters, but they had in their minds they were going to instigate some kind of conflict.
And certainly the TV cameras helped with that.
Right.
So everybody played a part in this whole thing. Before I let you guys go, just to give your thoughts on what the legacy of this convention has been. When you look back at this moment in history, what's been the legacy, whether it's Illinois, whether it's the city of Chicago, whether it's politics in general?
The immediate legacy was that it greatly damaged the Democratic Party. The party was already seriously split leading into the convention, and it was broken as a result of this convention. It left the nominee for president of the convention, Hubert Humphrey. He was vice president at the time, Vice President Humphrey, with, in my opinion, little chance of winning in the general election. He started out in a terrific hole with a terrific monkey on his back in the final months of the campaign because of the Chicago Convention. And I think the legacy is that it put the Democrats on the back burner nationally, and they did not make a comeback until the second term of Richard Nixon presidency, when Watergate took over the scene, and that allowed the Democrats to come into play big time again in our national political picture.
Yeah, and it's no surprise that what did Richard Nixon run on? Law and order. Law and order. And anybody who was watching what was going on in America with the riots after Martin Luther King assassination, but especially this one, as Taylor hinted at, you know, they were seeing these crazy kids in Chicago flying the Viet Cong flag, dragging down the American flag, climbing up on statues. I don't know that they saw many things like the protesters throwing urine and feces and calling the police officers pigs over and over and over again. But I think from a historical perspective, that part of it has been downplayed.
That's Mark DePew. He was director of the Oral History Project at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, and we spoke as well with Taylor Pinsonneau, a former reporter and author who covered the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. That conversation from 6 years ago, and we listen back today as another convention is rolling into town. We've got more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We've been talking about the Democratic National Convention held in Chicago in 1968, but are there lessons to be learned from that event? Robert Lorzel, with the program Curious City, went to find some answers.
People look back over the history of all those conventions. There's one year that stands out in everyone's mind, 1968. That was when protesters and police clashed in the streets. Now, as Chicago gets ready to host another Democratic National Convention, a listener asked Curious City, what lessons can we learn from 1968? Will the chaos repeat in 2024? To answer that question, we need to go back to 68. It's important to understand that the turmoil wasn't just in Chicago's streets.
The convention floor itself was completely chaotic.
Chicago lawyer John R. Schmidt was at the convention, working for Eugene McCarthy, a candidate opposed to the Vietnam War.
It's hard to exaggerate the level of anger and kind of tension in the convention hall. People started chanting and pounding their seat.
The delegates were arguing about the Vietnam War, the same issue firing up protesters out in the streets. While Schmidt was in the convention hall, Craig Sauter was protesting at the corner of Michigan Avenue and Balboa Drive as the National Guard fired off tear gas and Chicago police clubbed protesters.
And I saw an anchor man. I saw him climbing up the ladder of this truck, so I just followed him up the ladder. So I was up on top of that truck watching the action unfold. It was like, you know, like a revolution in Paris or something like that. It was really wild.
Police just grabbed somebody, are beating him over the head, and are trying to throw him into the paddy wagon.
Television networks began putting those scenes on the air. I remember just being horrified. And that's when Abe Ribicoff, who was the senator from Connecticut nominating McGovern, talked about Gestapo tactics.
And with George McGovern as president of the United States, we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago.
And that's when Mayor Daley stood up and shouted. It was incredibly hostile. And that scene going on at the same time as the networks were showing the police and the demonstrators in front of the Hilton, I think is what created that really indelible image of the Democratic Party is in chaos, and it probably had a lot to do with electing Richard Nixon.
So what lessons were learned from 1968? Partly as a result of all that chaos, conventions became more democratic. Instead of choosing the candidates in smoke-filled rooms, the parties let voters decide in primaries, and conventions got more boring. But this year's DNC might be more interesting, since President Joe Biden has dropped out of the race and Vice President Kamala Harris is the nominee-to-be. Schmidt says the current upheaval in the Democratic Party is a far cry from 1968.
That is nothing like the division that we had in 1968. And in terms of demonstrations out on the street, of course, there's a fundamental difference in the attitude of the city and the police.
In 2024, the city has been negotiating in court with a coalition protesting the war in Gaza. Liz Rathburn, a member of Students for a Democratic Society at UIC, is optimistic that the demonstrators will make an impact with a large, peaceful protest.
We're trying to have a family-friendly march of around 50,000 people. The city has already conceded to us that we have a right to march within sight and sound of the Democratic National Convention. And that's something that the 1968 protesters never had. They never got a permit.
Political consultant Don Rose was a spokesman for anti-war protesters in 68 when he coined a famous phrase.
I said, tell them they can't get away with this anymore because the whole world is watching.
the whole world will be watching again this month. Rose doesn't expect the same sort of violence, but he does think there might be scuffles, which Republicans could use to their advantage at a time when Democrats are trying to make up ground.
Democrats at the moment are in enough trouble already, so that's the kind of thing that could push them past the edge.
Chicago historian Rick Perlstein chronicled the 1968 convention in his book, Nixon Land. He doesn't expect the 2024 DNC to be a repeat of 68, but he admits it's hard to predict what will happen.
This is one of those moments in which history is a very poor guide for predicting anything because everything is so novel. You know, maybe people should be paying a little less attention to history and really just kind of looking at for what's happening right in front of their noses.
Perlstein says we're in uncharted waters. And so, while it's important to know our history, don't forget that we're living in history right now. For Curious City, I'm Robert Lowerzell.
Convention officials say they've surpassed their 40% goal of hiring minority or women-owned businesses. Esther Yoon-Gi King has details.
The convention takes place in Chicago next week. The host committee for the DNC has announced that nearly half of the major contracts for putting on the big event went to minority or women-owned businesses. Show Strategy is one of them. Glenn Charles Jr. is its CEO and says his was one of the biggest contracts for the event.
It's an experience of a lifetime. I want to prove to the world that people of color from diverse backgrounds, we have the capabilities to execute something on this scale.
His company is in charge of building the media tents and providing furniture and rentals for the DNC.
Esther Yoon-Gi King with that report. Delegates coming to the convention will be cheering on the Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris, but some Illinois delegates are also pleased with her vice presidential pick, Tim Walz, the Minnesota governor. Here's more from Tessa Weinberg.
Illinois Federation of Teachers President Dan Montgomery says he likes how Walz, a former teacher, connects with Midwesterners.
He did a great job of speaking progressive values to sort of middle America. The Harris-Walz ticket, to me, is a sort of dream team for public education.
Chicago Teachers Union President Stacey Davis-Gates touted Walz making school meals free for Minnesota students.
It means that the least of these have an opportunity to have their needs met in the type of America that Harris and Walz are leading.
The union's members are already campaigning for Harris in Michigan. Tessa Weinberg, WBEZ News.
Well, here's a fact you may not know. Chicago has hosted more political conventions than any other city. Yulian Haida has more on that story.
In Chicago's financial district, gleaming glass and steel skyscrapers tower hundreds of feet above. A look down at one sidewalk, there's an old bronze slab with the profile of a young Abraham Lincoln.
Here we are, the site of the wigwam in which Abraham Lincoln was nominated for president in 1860.
It's just a temporary wooden structure, no architectural significance.
Chicago historian John Schmidt is pointing out spots around town where 25 American presidential hopefuls were nominated to both Republican and Democratic ballots.
And this is where Abraham Lincoln, our greatest president, was started on the road to the White House, right here in Chicago.
The 1860 convention was the first ever hosted by the city. Local politicians used some pretty callous tactics to get the underdog Lincoln ahead of his more mainstream opponent.
What Lincoln's people did was print up counterfeit tickets to the wigwam and give those out to their supporters.
Edward Acorn is the author of The Lincoln Miracle, about the 1860 convention and all of the people behind the scenes who worked to get Lincoln nominated, including his campaign manager, David Davis.
Somebody said, you must have prevaricated somewhat. And he said, prevaricated? We lied like hell. So that was the Lincoln team. And he was Honest Abe, and that was his reputation. And these were the men representing him in Chicago, very practical, pragmatic guys who wanted to get the job done.
Chicago hosted 8 more conventions for the Republicans and Democrats through the end of the 19th century. Acorn says it was the ideal place to host conventions because, well, it was demographically representative of the United States, centrally located, and the kind of place where backroom deals could be made. That sort of brokered convention was typical for most of American history, says Nicole Hemmer, presidential historian at Vanderbilt University.
If somebody doesn't have enough delegates in order to be the outright nominee, then there needs to be some wheeling and dealing in order to figure out who the nominee is going to be.
All conducted, Hemmer says, in smoke-filled rooms by political elites.
This is the smoke-filled room, and you can recognize through the pipe, the little pipe design.
Pierre-Louis Giacotto, the general manager of the Blackstone Hotel in Chicago, opens the door for me to take a peek inside of room 915. In the thick of the 1920 Republican National Convention, nobody knew who the nominee would be. That is, until United Press reporter Raymond Clapper wandered the Blackstone's hallways to catch wind of who might lead the party. Clapper wrote that a senator from Kansas exited room 915 in the dead of night. Quote, "They're going to go for Senator Warren G. Harding, the candidate made in a smoke-filled room," unquote.
So they nominated him. He was elected. Very popular.
Historian John Schmidt.
Smoke-filled rooms gave us Abraham Lincoln and, you know, FDR and a bunch of good great presidents.
When delegates met again at the Chicago Stadium in 1940, it was a history-making move for Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Here's the amazing scene as the Democratic National Convention in Chicago names President Roosevelt as its candidate in the November elections. So the tradition of not standing for a third term is broken.
Historian Schmidt says that then-Chicago Mayor Ed Kelly really wanted a third term for FDR.
Ed Kelly had a man by the name of Gary, who was the head of his sewer department. And Mr. Gary brought out a whole bunch of sewer workers, and they packed the stands, the gallery of the Chicago Stadium. And when Roosevelt's name was mentioned, Mr. Gary is down in the basement, and he's got a special hookup to the auditorium. And finally, he starts going, "We want Roosevelt, we want Roosevelt." And of course, all the people in the stands going, "We want Roosevelt, we want Roosevelt."
Historians cite this early 20th century era as the golden age of machine politics. Political strongmen with the right connections conducted backdoor deals to get what they wanted in Chicago and nationally. For example, in 1960, when Republicans held their last convention in the city, they nominated Richard Nixon. He ended up losing to Democrat John F. Kennedy in the general election with the help of Chicago's boss, Mayor Richard J. Daley. A challenge to the machine came in the summer of 1968, though, when Democrats convened in Chicago to select a nominee for a 10th time.
When the Flower Children and thousands of other protesters hit the streets here next week.
It was just a few months after the murders of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. and presidential hopeful Robert F. Kennedy. Thousands of mostly young protesters descended on the Democratic National Convention to protest the Vietnam War. Judy Gumbo was an organizer with the Youth International Party, the Yippies, who coordinated much of the effort.
The Chicago cops were wired to do something to stop us, and we were wired to make our voices heard. And ultimately, both happened.
Mayor Daley made it clear with a now infamous quote saying he'd meet protesters with force.
To shoot to kill any arsonist or anyone with a Molotov cocktail in their hand in Chicago, to fire a building, because they're potential murderers.
The 1968 convention was a turning point. Afterwards, primary elections became the main way the state selected nominees, and it took decades for another nominating convention to come to Chicago. It was in 1996 that Richard J. Daley's son, then Mayor Richard M. Daley, made it his mission to rehabilitate the city's disastrous convention image.
You're not going to rewrite history. History cannot be rewritten. Maybe some people will try, but you can't.
And with tons of security, the 1996 convention went off without a hitch, nominating Bill Clinton to a second term. Now, nearly 3 decades later, Democrats will gather at Chicago's United Center for a celebratory roll call for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, the nominees already chosen to head the Democratic presidential ticket.
This marks the 26th time Chicago has hosted a national political convention. Remember, you can listen to convention coverage. It starts Monday right here on this NPR station. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. And remember to be with us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.